This is the Medicast, November 5th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 91. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome everybody again this week to this podcast. If you're a brand new listener, I urge you to head on over to the Medicast website at medicast.com and check out this episode and all of the other previous episodes and other great information available over at the Medicast website. It's great to have you here, and I urge you to check back into that all the information that is there. Also, remember that all of the information I talk about is linked to in the show notes for each episode, so you can search the website and find out all of that information available over there with links to everywhere that I get information or have listed as good links for information for each episode, so check that out. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you again for staying subscribed to the show and listening and sending in your comments and your questions and all of your other input that you send in to help keep me straight and keep the information here on the Medicast up to date and current in what we present to each other and share here on the show. It's a great forum here in this podcast for me to share information with you and also for the rest of you to send information back in. And when we get to the listener mail here in a few minutes, you will hear exactly what I'm talking about because we've gotten some good information back in response to a listener question. And I really appreciate that feedback because that is what I like to see from our community, that we help each other out, that we continue to grow our networking ability and our the way we keep in touch with each other and support each other no matter where we are practicing in the world around us. So thanks a lot for all of that feedback. I want to put out one more call real quick here for anybody that is interested in Wilderness EMS or wants to know more about Wilderness EMS. Coming up on November 13th, that's a Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be hosting another episode of the Medicast Live. This is a live call-in chat show where we will have an expert on or two, as well as perhaps some other EMS podcasters or bloggers that will all be here to talk about, discuss, and answer listener questions regarding Wilderness EMS. That's the topic for this month's episode of the Medicast Live. It'll be great for any and all of you to join in. You can actually listen live to the show via web streaming. You can call in live to the show, and you can also chat live in the chat room while the show's going on. All of those great ways for you to contribute and participate and get your questions answered. And I certainly love it when everybody joins in. We've had, I guess, the most we've had participate at one time has been about 20 listeners. Usually it averages out to around between 8 and 10. I'd love to have another group of 20 show up. It's just wonderful because all of those questions in the chat room can be brought forward to the guests on the show, and we can get all of our questions answered. And again, it's just a great opportunity for everybody to share. And that's going to be coming up on November 13th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find out more details. Go to MedicCastLive.com, which will take you directly to the MedicCast Live page at TalkShoe.com. TalkShoe is a service I use to host and handle the live call-in features. And you can sign up for a free account over there, and it'll tell you exactly how you can download the software you'll need to just quickly load on your computer. You'll have the TalkShoe software in place. And then when you load up the show on the night of the episode, you'll actually be able to participate live. And it's a great forum for everybody. Well, it was a great week for listener mail and listener voicemail, so I'm going to jump into that right away here. First of all, I'd like to thank listener Emily. She sent in some information related to a past episode where we talked a little bit about the red emergency transmit buttons that we have on some of our portable radios. And this is, of course, for those of you that don't know what that is, it's a emergency transmit button that it's a panic button. If something's going on, if you're being attacked, if there's immediate need for assistance, you push that button, and depending on your system, it will open up the channel. It actually clears other traffic from the trunked channel and sends a open air message, opens up your microphone automatically for a period of time, usually 4 or 5 seconds or so. And so the dispatchers can actually hear exactly what's going on in the background. And then, of course, if you hit it by accident, what happens? Well, there's different services that do different things. And Emily was just sharing that her service actually has to repeat a code phrase back over the air to let people know at the dispatch center that they're doing okay. And if they don't repeat that code phrase, then they will have a police agency dispatched out for assistance. So, Emily, thank you for responding to that. You know, if you're listening to a back episode and you have a comment, something to contribute to the discussion, please, please send in your comments by email just like Emily did. Certainly appreciate it. If you hadn't been over to the Medicast website this week, I posted up a bit of a discussion that I'd been having recently with our good friend Chris Black, and it has to do with patient refusals and medical control. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail on it, but I just wanted to touch base with you that Chris has posted up in the comments section of that post, the second post of the week for that discussion. He has a comment response that he had exchanged emails with Dr. Brian Bledsoe, and he includes some of Brian Bledsoe's comments back to him in his comment on the discussion at the Medicast site. So head over and look at the past week's postings over at the Medicast blog, and you'll see my setup of that discussion, my answer back to Chris based on his hypothetical question about refusals, competency, and medical direction. And then also Dr. Brian Bledsoe's comments are listed on that second post comment section as well. So all right there at the Medicast. And Chris, again, I thank you for bringing up that provocative question. I got emails from longtime listener Helen as well as listener Jason, both sending in comments that they're excited about the upcoming Wilderness EMS show, and I hope that both of you will be able to get online and participate in that program as well. Anybody else that is interested in joining us, please feel free to do so. And if you are a Wilderness EMT, I'd like to have you on as a special guest of the show, talk to you specifically about how the training differs from your EMTB or paramedic programs, and what the focus is, because this is something that I don't know much about, and I'm educating myself, as well as I know that many other listeners are not aware of the differences between Wilderness EMS and urban or rural, regular rural EMS. So I'm looking forward to hearing back from you. So please get in touch with me. I'd love to have you on as a guest next on this show coming up on November 13th at the Medicast. I got an email from listener Mitch, who is involved in EMS and nursing and would like to touch base with me about EMS in France. And he has some experience with that. And he has some information about French EMS programs. I'm going to post that up during the week this week in the blog because there's a lot of good information there. But one of the questions and statements that he brought up was that EMTs, or the basic first responders, and nurses in the field are not allowed to listen to heart or breath sounds, according to what he says here, and that is reserved solely for the doctors, that they're not supposed to even listen. And he would like to get some additional training anyway and wanted to know about good sites to check out. Well, first of all, I'll tell you, if you Google heart sound MP3 or breath sound MP3, you'll get a whole host of links to different medical schools, different paramedic programs all over that you can actually listen to those live on the internet. And there are also some great CDs that you can purchase that have that information recorded on them. Although I don't have a problem with anybody buying any CDs like that, but that information is also available for free to listen to on web pages for different medical schools and educational facilities. You can listen right on the page. So I would do that and listen. You can learn that way. I will share with the listener, Mitch, that sent in this particular information to us from about French EMS that in the United States, at least in my area, and I think a lot of advanced paramedic providers would agree with me on this, that we are urged to listen to breath sounds and also really urged to get out there and sharpen up our heart sound skills so that we can pick up on things like murmurs, on things like summation gallop and things like that, where we're hearing actual changes in heart sounds based on the way that the valves are opening and closing in the heart. And I would say that that's something that at the very least at the EMTB level, you should have some familiarity with. And at the paramedic and nursing program level, you really should be getting a better handle on listening to at least apical heart sounds. And if nothing else, beyond that, at least that minimum, and having a good sense of listening to and distinguishing breath sounds. So I hope that answers your question, and thanks very much for your comment. Finally, I got two different responses back regarding the UK paramedic that was asking about transferring certification or getting certification using his existing EMS background from the UK here in the United States. And I got that a couple of weeks ago, I guess, and I've been sending the call out to follow up on that. And I'd just like to first touch with base with the email I got, and then I got a really great voicemail sent in, and that person called in on the MedicCast voicemail line and left a message. So I'll play that second. First of all, this is from listener Flo from down in Australia. And I want to tell you guys from down under, thank you very much for listening to the show. I really enjoy all your comments. And anything you'd like to share about EMS in Australia is greatly welcomed. It's one of those places I want to visit someday. I promised my wife I'm going to take her there. So maybe this will be an excuse for me to do that sooner than later and maybe do a tour of some of your facilities and organizations down there and make it part of a MedicCast program of the future sometime. So maybe in a few years I can save up and we can get down there. But I certainly appreciate listener Flo sending this one in. First of all, Flo recently got their certification in the Western Australian Ambulance Service and is going to start the paramedical science degree soon. So congratulations to you, and I hope that continues well. Also, there was a mention of a BBC show from about 2004 talking about a paramedic in England who relocated his family to Canada and that was transferring some of his certification. So there might be some information in an old BBC episode that you might be able to search for on the web. And with that said, I'll head on over and check out the voicemail I got.
Hi, Jamie. My name is Alex Hoff. I'm a paramedic here in Indianapolis, Indiana. And getting back to your statement about how people from the UK can come over here to the States and get their National Registry medic certification. I recently had a friend who did just that. He came over from the States, from the UK, over here to get his medic cert, since it's going to be a little bit more recognizable than, you know, here in the States and then coming over with the certification from there. Pelham Training in Bloomington, Indiana has a program that is an accelerated paramedic program. This is a program that is based on some of the way that the military trains their pararescue and some of their IEMTs, which is the independent emergency medical technicians. It's a 90-day program, and in that 90-day program, it's Monday through Thursday, 8 to 5, book work, course reading tests. Friday through Sunday is going to be your clinical. So it's a very intense, very militaristic style of class designed for people who are coming back from the military that need civilian certs to work here in the States, designed for people who have extensive experience in EMS and are going to be able to handle that kind of course load. They also have, if someone thinks they can do it without retaking the paramedic exam, Pelham Training offers a National Registry preparatory course. It's a one-week course that covers everything that you need to know for that National Registry exam. So if someone comes over from the UK or from somewhere else other than the States here and has been through a paramedic course and knows that knowledge, they can take this National Registry prep course and just learn the things that are going to be needed to do for the National Registry exam so that they can take it and have a chance of passing it. Now, if you don't pass, they also do a, you can retake any part of that review and continue to take your National Registry, and it's all free of charge until you finally pass. I know a guy had a friend of mine who couldn't pass and took the National Registry prep course, and lo and behold, he passed it immediately after that. So just kind of throwing that out there to you, you know, to the listeners. I know I'm a big fan of the show. And it's a fantastic course. These guys who go through the accelerated medic course are great. You know, it's a very intense course, but they seem to get through it. The pass rate is still in the 90th percentile on the National Registry. And so, you know, you get a lot of people through, you take on a lot of knowledge, and if you have a lot of experience in EMS, it should come pretty easily to you. And the National Registry Prep course is the same way. It's a fantastic program. It's a week long that is going to prepare you for everything that you need to know for that test, and then some.
Alex, thank you very much for that voicemail and sharing that information with all of our listeners. Hopefully it will help out those that are interested in transferring their certifications or in an accelerated program. It sounds like it's very in-depth and very intensive, but if you are a person that's receptive to that kind of learning style, then I think this is a good program for you. I mean, this is something that maybe not for everyone, but I think that for people that are good self-starters that have their own medical background in another field that are looking to become paramedics, this might be just a perfect fit. So, Alex, thank you very much. And I will try to get a link to that particular program from Alex, and I will get back in touch with the rest of you when I have that and include it either on the blog page or as a link of the week in the future on the website show notes for the program each week. The link of the week this week will be to Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast. Everybody knows, I think, if you've listened to the show for a while, that Rick is a good friend of this podcast. And Rick's podcast over at the Mitigation Journal is a great podcast focusing on disaster-related implementation. How are you ready for disasters in your community, in your service, everywhere that you may respond? Whether you are a basic first responder all the way up to hospital and public health people, all can gain a lot from listening to Rick's Mitigation Journal podcast. As a bonus, if you are a student of EMS, Rick does regular in-service programs for his local community college program for paramedics. And in these in-services, he touches base on topics that the students want some extra information on. And he puts that all up on the Mitigation Journal podcast in the midweek segment. So you can get a lot of great information over there on anything from acid-base balance to reviewing respiratory distress calls, all of that over at themitigationjournal.com. And I urge you to check that out. I'll lead off the news this week with a story coming out of Washington that talks about FEMA and their storm preparedness plans. Now, here we are at the end of the Atlantic hurricane season, and here we have a story that is discussing whether the Federal Emergency Management Agency is prepared yet for dealing with major hurricanes striking the United States. And yet again, here we are, more than 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, and the federal government still seems to not have their act together for their response. And this is based upon the FEMA's refusal to release a report that looks at gap analysis. This is looking at where they still have to make up some ground in how they're going to respond for major storms in U.S. coastal areas. The agency says that they do not have to release this report because it involves critical infrastructure and is not available under the Freedom of Information Act. This, I don't understand how they can get away with this particular argument, since I can't see how storm preparedness has anything to do with anti-terrorism efforts. I'm sorry, I don't see that FEMA's response to a major hurricane like Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Andrew or any of the other major storms that have hit the U.S. has anything to do with national security, or at least the entire report, doesn't have anything to do with national security. Fine. If you've got something in there about some major military response that might be needed, exit out. I don't care. What about the rest of it? What is your excuse for still, more than 2 years later, not having a plan in place to deal with this kind of issue? Okay, time to put the soapbox away. I'll get down. I'm sorry. Let's move on to the next issue that we're dealing with in the news this week. Found an article over at medicinenet.com talking about defibrillator use and use for children as well as adults. And this is something that I think the most of us that have been doing recent training are well aware of, but maybe you haven't reserted in the last few months or a year and haven't gotten this information. The American Academy of Pediatrics is releasing a new position, which is saying that devices such as AEDs can be used on children younger than 8 years old, that AEDs need to be available and possibly used on anyone in cardiac arrest if you have no other choice. This is because recent studies have shown that, in fact, children do go into ventricular fibrillation. It had, I think, previously been discussed that the issues in children's hearts were not the same as adults and that an AED would provide no real benefit. I would say to you, if all you have is an AED and CPR and you don't have anything else immediately available to you in the way of advanced care, I'd rather take a chance and try to use that AED because I had a pulseless apneic child who all I had to do was CPR. If I've been doing my 2 minutes of CPR and I had no other response out of this child, I would most likely use the AED, whether it was immediately indicated in protocol or not, if I did not have access to any other resources. So if you're in a situation in the public where an AED is available to you, I think you should at least consider use of an AED on a child younger than 8 if you have no other recourse. And again, you always have your cell phone. Call medical command, some medical command, any medical command, and get permission from them. Better yet, don't wait until you actually stumble upon a child in cardiac arrest in a public setting. Why don't you talk to your docs the next time you're at the ED and ask them, hey, what would you do in this situation? Do you believe it's warranted? Or check your protocols, check with your agency's medical director yourself and find out what their take is on this. Maybe it's time for a rewrite of your particular agency's protocols to allow for some out-of-the-box use of this particular device. I'll move on to the next story, and it has to do with a sad case of a boy in Brooklyn who died from a MRSA infection in New York City, and the family is alleging that he was misdiagnosed and has filed a $25 million lawsuit against the city of New York for not properly identifying his illness as a MRSA infection in time for him to receive appropriate treatment. And I don't bring this up to point out that people are way too quick to file lawsuits because I'm not going to get into that discussion at this time. But I think this case points out something else as I read the facts involving this case. This particular boy was 12 years old and was taken to the hospital where he was looked at the New York City public hospital system at Kings County Hospital Center. And the doctor there looked at the rash that was presented and thought that the boy had an allergic reaction. Didn't realize he was dealing with a possible beginning sepsis and basically sent him home with Benadryl. And didn't think anything more of it, thinking he was having some kind of an allergic reaction. And this is the point I want to make to all of you. You need to educate yourselves on different types of rashes. And with any rash, with the prevalence of skin infections and MRSA out there right now, we need to treat any rash as if it might be MRSA. That means you need to be using your universal precautions, scene safety BSI, I say it over and over and over again. Put on your gloves if you have anybody with any kind of rash. Assume that rash is some kind of infectious rash. Even if you are pretty sure it's just an allergic reaction or some other topical effect from contact with something, you just need to treat it as if it was an infectious situation. And that way you will not, A, possibly contract MRSA yourself, or B, transfer MRSA to some other part of your equipment and area and end up giving it to the next patient who may be an elderly patient or a very young patient or somebody else with a compromised immune system. And this advantageous infection takes effect on them as well. So that's what I wanted to take away from this particular article. You can head on over to the link in the show notes and check out the rest of the details yourself. Finally, I'll wrap up this week's news items with a study that was done, and I found this over at medicalnewstoday.com, and it's talking about the increasing prevalence of heart disease-related conditions in younger and younger adults. You know, we used to see patients with cardiac disease, with cardiovascular problems at, you know, maybe older than 55, 60 years old, we'd start seeing an increased prevalence of this. Well, this is being seen in younger and younger adults. Heart disease, high blood pressure, hardening of the arteries, all usually associated with senior citizens, is now increasingly seen in younger and younger adults. And this was an analysis of adults patients between 2001 and 2006, where they looked at 20 to 44 year old patients taking prescription medications and found that there was an increase in 68% for those taking high cholesterol meds and an increase of 21% in those taking antihypertensive medications like ACE inhibitors, calcium channel blockers, and beta blockers. And there may be good news and bad news, according to the author of this, one of the authors of this story, basically saying that younger patients are taking medications to control these problems earlier, therefore staving off long-term problems, or at least getting them treated earlier and hopefully lessening the effects of these diseases on them later in life. But there's also a problem that we may be seeing an increased number, along with the increase in obesity and the lack of exercise in our populations, that we are seeing patients more and more frequently at a younger age. Think about, if you've been around for a while, how much more frequently you're running into younger chest pain patients, younger cardiac arrest patients, and really wondering, you know, this guy had so much time ahead of him, he looks like crap. Well, it's because these people are aging faster based on their lifestyles. And so we need to have a better handle on treating these patients. And that's going to kind of lead me into this week's tip of the week. I urge you to head on over and check out the full study article over at medicalnewstoday.com. I have a link in the show notes. But I wanted to kind of jump on to this week's tip of the week, which is really telling us all that we need to review and spruce up our knowledge of dealing with cardiac patients, and specifically for those of us that are ALS providers, ACLS skills. So for the tip of the week this week, I will be talking about at least an introduction to ACLS, at least my own personal view of digging into ACLS. And while this is, I guess, primarily for the ALS providers listening to the show, I would urge all BLS providers to really keep your ears open and listen along. The reason for that is that we don't work in a vacuum. Often when we are dealing with patients, we are going to have a mixed crew involved. Whether that crew member is eventually going to move up front and be the driver, that BLS provider still can be a valuable part of any ACLS intervention team because of anticipation of what might be needed next, especially in a critical patient. So it's really a good idea for you to be aware of things like checking to make sure leads are on and it properly attached to the patient if we're doing any kind of checks of things like asystole or other problems. We really want to make sure that we know that all leads are in place. That's not always a problem with some of the more modern monitors that check and will actually send you a warning signal to let you know that a lead is detached. But if that feature is not working or turned off for some reason in a software fashion, you still need to be able to do those kind of things. And that is the kind of time-saving intervention that can free the paramedic or the medic up to get prepared for the next step in the treatment process. As I said before, because more and more younger people are dealing with cardiac disease issues at a younger age, it really means that we're going to see more and more patients dealing with cardiac problems that are relatively young and therefore really shouldn't be expected to have a poor survivability necessarily from a cardiac event. We should be able to utilize their youth and hopefully a more vigorous response system to keep them alive longer and get them to the hospital so that they can have definitive treatments that will prolong their life, like cardiac catheterization or bypass surgery. I have a link in the show notes to a site that I visit frequently just to kind of refresh my own memory and use of different ACLS algorithm points. And that is a site called ACLS.net. And I just link to them in the show notes, but you can head directly there, ACLS.net. That will get you there. They have quizzes. They have a simulator. They have links to their own versions of the algorithms with some mnemonic devices, all great tools that you can use. Also, you can find all kinds of other access either in your protocols or perhaps at local educational institutions and, of course, the American Heart Association, all four links to different ways to look at ACLS. Right now, I will be looking at an overview of ACLS. And in other episodes of the podcast, in the tip and trick of the week, you could use the website at medicast.com and search for other specific types of ACLS interventions, whether it's medications or specific cardiac events that I might be dealing with in other tips, either in the past episodes or in upcoming episodes. I intend to have all the ACLS tips covered here at some point in the coming months, if I haven't covered them already in the past. The first thing I want to talk about in a broad overview of ACLS is that ACLS has a lot of charts, a lot of algorithms, a lot of things that you can look at, but there needs to be a basic understanding of how simple at its basis ACLS really is. The focus of any advanced cardiac life support intervention plan should be to keep the patient from advancing farther into a lethal algorithm or a lethal rhythm. And this means that if you've got a patient who's experiencing mild chest pain and they are starting to get more and more diaphoretic, you're starting to see more and more ST elevation in the 12 lead, what's your goal? Think about your ACLS interventions in this manner. What is your plan going to be for this patient? And then use that thought process to tell you logically where you should head next. Okay? Patient has chest pain. We do not want them to get to the point where they start having VTAC, where they start developing a heart block, where they start progressing farther into a full AMI event. We want to stave that off by doing the things we know to do, which ACLS algorithms tell us we need to treat these patients with nitrates, with pain management perhaps, with dealing with the things we do to reduce oxygen demand on the heart to allow the heart muscle to recover and get back to its prior baseline. And we do that on the way to the hospital, and the hospital follows up further with their advanced treatments, whether it's catheterization or open heart surgery as necessary. So I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about just an overview of what we would look at each stage of an ACLS intervention. And first of all, of course, that starts off with a good assessment. Get your initial assessment done. What does the patient look like? Their skin color, their skin temperature, their skin condition, their respiratory work of breathing. You know, you can almost apply some of the pediatric triangle to a major cardiac patient. These people look sick. If they're still conscious, that's clear. So you need to just treat the symptoms that you're looking at, make sure you're following your protocols, and keep it simple, okay? The KISS principle applies here in many cases. If you know what meds you have in your toolbox and you know your doses for these meds, making the next logical step to what you need to do next doesn't need to be referring to a really complex algorithm chart. It really means just thinking about, okay, what am I trying to do to get this patient to be more stable? So for instance, if you have a patient who has a slow heart rate, first of all, you need to be able to examine and identify and diagnose what the specific rhythm is. I'm not saying that, but you do have the ability to look at it and say, that's too slow, right? If you have a patient who's showing a systole, double check and make sure all your leads are in place. Simple things like that. Then move to the next step. All right, now what do I need to do? I need to restore some kind of a rhythm to the heart so that when I get back to CPR and get that working, perhaps the heart will start on its own. Perhaps the heart will move into a shockable rhythm, but no rhythm isn't going to give you anything. The same thing with bradycardia or tachycardia. If it's too slow, you need to take steps to speed it up. That may be mechanically speeding it up with pacing, or it may be medically speeding it up with pharmaceuticals, administering things like atropine to try to create a situation where the heart can speed itself up. Tachycardia, you need to slow the heart down. Well, will vagal maneuvers suffice if it's an SVT? Okay, this patient may have already tried those things, or this may be something that's new and the patient hasn't. So you get them to apply vagal maneuvers, and maybe that's all you need to do. In the process of them doing that, you can be drawing up your adenosine and getting ready for that intervention, or making the determination that you need to go right to electrocardioversion. So again, it's simpler than it's made to seem sometimes. If it's too slow, speed it up. If it's too fast, slow it down. If you have symptoms where the heart is experiencing distress because it's not getting enough oxygen, then you need to take steps to help oxygenate it. That means, yes, give oxygen. That means, yes, take the next step and administer nitrates if those are indicated. I also want to point out that if you're giving nitrates to a patient without an IV line in place, you are just tempting fate. Okay? That's my own personal view. You may have a protocol like mine that allows you to administer nitroglycerin to a patient who has a prescription for it without an IV in place. Well, even if you've taken your set of vitals and know that the blood pressure's in good shape, without an IV in place, you have no way to restore that blood pressure quickly if they should bottom out because of a reaction to nitroglycerin or because they're experiencing some kind of a right-sided or posterior cardiac event and you've just reduced their ability to have preload. Again, these are just some basic overview points before we dig into the meat of ACLS in future episodes, and that is to think about what you're doing with each patient and make it as simple as possible. And I think this will lead to you having ultimately a lot of success as you start looking at the individual algorithms, because you'll see how really simple they actually are. For this week's Med of the Week, I'm going to be looking at amiodarone, and I will be coupling in future episodes different medications to go along with the different ACLS algorithms. And I should be touching on a coupling of tips and medications like this probably once a month or so until we're finished. Hopefully sometime early next spring, I will have all of the ACLS interventions and medications taken care of on the show, because there's been a lot of call for that. And I want to make sure that I'm providing the tips and tools that make the show useful for you, the listener. Amiodarone is an antiarrhythmic agent that is used for different types of rapid heartbeats, tachyarrhythmias that are both ventricular and supraventricular in nature. This, of course, differentiates it from the old standby of lidocaine, which was primarily having only a ventricular effect, being essentially an anesthetic, a local anesthetic administered intravascularly that was able to calm down the ventricles when they were overexcited for some reason, as in VFib and VTAC. Amiodarone is available both as an oral pill and in IV solutions. Orally, it's given to patients primarily with some kind of atrial fibrillation issue or a flutter where it's calming down their atrial tachycardias and preventing the rapid ventricular response that might follow on. The amiodarone is thought to work primarily on extending the contraction interval. In other words, slowing down the response to reset for the next contraction in that refractory period, allowing the ventricles to take longer to accept the next impulse. And this provides for slowing down the heart rhythm. The indications for use of amiodarone are included in ventricular fibrillation and pulseless VTAC. In this situation, you would, of course, want to immediately start CPR, get your defibrillator in place, check your rhythm, and go ahead and shock the VFib or the pulseless VTAC. Then begin CPR again for 2 minutes immediately. Check for pulse at the end of that 2 minutes of CPR. And in that point, you're going to go ahead and give your epi as your first-line medication, and then amiodarone if indicated and there's no response to the epinephrine. And then you're going to alternate epi and then another dose of amiodarone. Initial dose would be 300 milligrams. Follow-up dose would be 150 milligrams. If you have a ventricular tachycardia with a pulse in a stable patient, you're going to go ahead and think about administering amiodarone to that patient, usually at a dose of about 150 milligrams administered in slow IV push. If you have an unstable VTAC, though, a patient who is hemodynamically compromised, you're going to want to go ahead and prepare for immediate electronic cardioversion. You want to try to convert that rhythm. Again, our goal in ACLS is to prevent worsening of the rhythm progression. If they're in pulse, if they're in VTAC with a pulse and they're decompensating, the next step is pulseless VTAC. They're not going to get better on their own, in my estimation. So you need to go ahead and be prepared to treat that dynamically. If you believe the patient is stable enough, you can go ahead and administer amiodarone if you already have a line in place. However, it may be more indicated for an unstable patient to go ahead and immediately cardiovert them. Amiodarone is also possibly indicated in the treatment of patients with atrial fibrillation. However, you may be more familiar with using something like diltiazem or another calcium channel blocker in the treatment of AFib with rapid ventricular response. So you'll have to refer to your own protocols for that particular problem. Contraindications, really the only absolute contraindication for the use of amiodarone in an emergency setting is a history of an allergic response to amiodarone. And in this situation, you would then fall back on something like lidocaine if you were looking to treat the situations that I mentioned above. There are side effects to people that are taking long-term use of amiodarone. Usually, according to most studies, anyone who is on long-term amiodarone use will experience at least one of the listed side effects. And these include issues with thyroid function, including hypo and hyperthyroid effects. Other effects include corneal deposits on the eye, and also a prominent lung fibrosis effect. And this effect seems to jump in even after people have only been on amiodarone for about a week. Others never develop it. Others take years to develop. But it is a basic loss of elasticity in the lungs tissue itself and causing them to have reduced respiratory function as a result of taking this particular medication. As far as short-term effects that we might see in an acute cardiac event, this is usually simply a reverse effect of what we were treating to begin with. In other words, you're treating a tachycardia, you end up having a patient that develops some sort of profound bradycardic event. And in that case, you would go ahead and treat the bradycardia accordingly, especially since you would suspect that it is merely an effect of your amiodarone treatment. It's also important to remember to document that this bradycardia happened following X dose of amiodarone. It may be an indication that this patient is a little more sensitive to this particular drug and needs to have their average dosage lessened when you get to the emergency department. And this is important because, again, this patient would be indicated to have a drip hung of amiodarone to maintain the effect that you saw in administering a bolus amiodarone. And if they are more susceptible to a bradycardia, that drip setting may be lessened to the lower end of the dosage spectrum in order to meet the patient's needs without overloading them if they're more sensitive to the drug. So that's the drug amiodarone as a med of the week, and I think that'll wrap up this week's tip and med for the MedicCast. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'd like to thank all of you for checking out the show and staying in touch. As always, you can reach me here at the MedicCast by email at podmedic@mac.com. That's podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me by voicemail at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. That's a Skype voicemail line, so if you're on the Skype system, you can reach me directly via Skype at PodMedic and leave a message on that same voicemail system if you already are using the Skype voice over internet program. You can also leave comments over at the MedicCast website. Over there at the MedicCast, you'll find the show notes for tonight's episode, as well as all of the other articles, links, and posts that I put up throughout the week as ways to keep you in touch with other things that are going on in the medical community. And each one of those posts allows you to leave a comment at the bottom. You would just go in. If you're already registered at the site, you can sign in and leave your comment. If you haven't registered before, it might take about 24 hours for your comment to show up, because I do approve each individual sign up personally to avoid spam issues. But your comment will show up there, and it's a great way to hold a discussion on the different topics that I bring up during the week. If you want an example of that, check out last week's posts about patient refusals and medical control and how we deal with who's competent and who's not competent. A lot of great follow-up comments to last week's articles at the MedicCast. And that can all be found at MedicCast.com. The number one way, of course, to support the show, though, is to let your friends know about the MedicCast. Spread the word about the MedicCast and the MedicCast community and how it has helped you in your service as a paramedic, EMT, or other medical professional. What have you learned from the show? How has it helped you pass a test or prepare for a recertification? Whatever. It is great to hear back from you when you send me comments about that, and I know that other people would appreciate to hear those comments as well. You can let your friends know, or you can head on over to iTunes at the iTunes store and leave a comment on the MedicCast page there. Let them get a review of your thoughts on how the MedicCast has helped you out. All of that helps out the show greatly, and you can join some of the other reviewers over at that site over at the iTunes store. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This next artist that you'll hear is named Whitney Steele, and I heard her perform live over at the Podcast Expo when I was there in September, and really had a great time. She has some great music, and I'm going to lead off here, or end up the show, I guess, here with her song, Stumble. Great music. If you like what you hear, head on over and check out Whitney's site at WhitneySteele.com, and that's Steele with an E. And if you'd like a direct link, I have a link to it in the show notes as well. This is her song, Stumble, coming up. I will end now by saying, this is Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. Until next time, Scene Safety, BSI.
If you just let go, the wind might blow you right back to me. 'Cause I'm all alone, and I want you to know that I miss you and the way you made me feel. All the things I should have said were always running through my head, but I'd stop. Someone else away. stay.